If you earn minimum wage in the U.S., it's likely you cannot afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in the country. According to a recent study by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, you'd need to make an average of $22 an hour to afford a two-bedroom. The cost of a public college education in America has more than doubled since 1996, and daycare can eat up about 30% of a parent's income. So it's no wonder that millions of Americans who are in the middle class feel as if they're on shaky economic ground. Author Alyssa Court says they are, and it wouldn't take much to put them in jeopardy.
It's just one bad thing, one hard thing. You know, you have an elderly parent that's struggling. Your child has a physical or mental problem. You have to get another degree because you've been downsized and your job has been reimagined. And then what are you going to do?
Alyssa Court knows that firsthand. She and her husband were both freelance journalists. When they were expecting their first child, they wrestled with the prospect of additional costs. That experience became the genesis for her new book called Squeezed: Why Our Families Cannot Afford America. In Squeezed, Alyssa Court speaks with adjunct college professors and Uber drivers and nannies and says we tend to think that it's just the working poor who are struggling to make it, but it's not.
I talked to a librarian in Minnesota, and her husband worked in IT, and they were living in a one-bedroom apartment. Their son was sleeping in their same room with them, and they were in a great amount of educational debt, and the birth of her son had cost a lot. They owed $20,000 in hospital bills. And the term I use to describe this condition is the middle precariat.
Which means what?
It's precarious. They're living on the edge of not knowing what's going to happen next year. Adjuncts experience this. So do lawyers who have to hop from gig to gig, accountants, a whole range of different people I spoke to.
Yeah, you say that middle class life now is 30% more expensive than it was 20 years ago. Why is that? Why the change?
Well, I think the big thing that we have to talk about here is taxes, which are relentless for middle-class population. Right now, you're being dinged under so-called tax reform for being self-employed. So these are things that one of the things was taxes. Another is income inequality itself. We have, in America, the largest wealth inequality gap of 200 countries, according to a global wealth report in 2015. That's the largest wealth inequality gap. And when the top 1% has so much more than even the top 10%, the middle class is financially and also mentally outclassed at every step. So, I mean, I talked to someone who was making very low six figures, and you think, oh my gosh, that's a wealthy person.
This is a guy who had a job working for Weather Underground
right,
as a meteorologist.
Sean, but he commuted hours each day. His wife was taking care of their three children, and they were trying to keep up in this incredibly expensive part of the country, you know, Silicon Valley.
But his problems are real. As you say, it's hard to feel sorry for
somebody. It's hard to feel sorry, and I wanted to give a continuum. So I wanted to show people in the lower middle class who were kind of striving and not quite getting into the middle class, and also people who we would say, oh, they're fine, they're doing fine. What are they moaning about? They're kvetching, you know. But I wanted to show that there is a kind of suffering for them too.
And on the other end, you have what you call extreme daycare, and you profile someone named Dolores Hogan, who runs Dee's Tots Childcare in New Rochelle, New York. This is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for people who work shifts all around the clock and have to drop off their kids at pretty much any time of day. You spent time there. You kind of embedded at Dee's Tots Childcare. What did you see?
I saw these two incredibly caring people who are married who run a 24-hour daycare. I call it extreme daycare because the parents would drop them off, the kids off at 7 in the morning. They might pick them up at 10 at night, and they might put them in daycare for a couple hours and then spend time with them and then drop them off again because they were working multiple jobs, which is a condition that many people have to do right now to survive.
Can you read part of that chapter?
Oh, absolutely.
This is you're talking about the Hogans, an African-American couple that runs this daycare center.
So this was at the 24-hour daycare, which was a really warm, loving place. But, you know, the kids were, they missed their parents. So on one of my visits, giant puffy pencils and teddy bear balloons were hanging from the front fence, and kids were jumping on a bouncy house, giving the place a touch of the carnival. At twilight, two children helped Dolores water her cucumber and melon plants while keeping their eyes out for plundering raccoons. I'm going to move on for a later section. These 24-hour kids seemed all right, for now, at least, and unusually self-sufficient. One night, Diana, Marisol's 8-year-old daughter, showed me how to perfectly squeeze toothpaste out of a tube, like in a commercial. Her 4-year-old sister, Yvette, brushed her own teeth without being asked. I saw a little of the sorrow or loneliness one might expect to see in these kids, though I did catch ripples of uncertainty and need. A few of the children did seem parentified in the useful but awkward psychology parlance. They seemed wise beyond their years, having been forced to grow up and parent themselves earlier than we might wish.
Many of the people that you profile in the book are, like the Hogans, care workers, daycare directors, nannies, teachers, professors, nurses. And you argue that these professions, the caring professions, are especially poorly paid because, as you say, care work is devalued and even disdained. What is the stigma around these professions?
I think there's a contempt for care work and caregiving in this country that seeps into how we think about mothers, professional workers who are mothers. A survey showed that people would offer $11,000 less to a mother than to a childless woman, and obviously much more to a man. And I think it's part of our discomfort with vulnerability and need and people whose work has a kind of an emotional element.
Is that a particularly American characteristic?
I think so. I mean, I'm sure there's other places that would echo that, and I don't want to make a broad estimate. But if you look at the daycare offerings of many other countries,
in terms of subsidies,
they're so much higher, from Scandinavia to Canada.
Like what? How does it work there?
In Quebec, for instance, maternity and paternity leave insurance gives a parent up to 75% of his or her salary and covers up to 15 or 18 continuous weeks for the mother. You know, in Denmark, mothers get 4 weeks of paid pregnancy leave before their child is born. And in America, 13 to 14% of jobs have paid family leave.
How much do they pay in Canada for daycare?
$7 to $20 a day in Quebec, in Montreal.
A day?
Yeah.
Not just an hour, but a day.
And then you think about American daycare facilities where, you know, on the low end, it's like $10,000 to $14,000, and on the high end, it can be like $30,000 a year.
So in the larger picture, there's changing the mindset as we look towards solutions to these problems. This is, you know, a series of systemic problems. Globalization gets into it. Roboticization gets into it. And the stripping of jobs. You go into that in the book. What are the solutions that you came across?
Things like universal pre-K, which has been flourishing in New York City, would be great across the board, across this country. And they're starting 3K for 3-year-olds. One of the architects of it was telling me how parents who enrolled their kids in universal pre-K felt a psychological well-being having their kids there for the day. It wasn't just financial. It was in a public school setting, not in an informal daycare, for instance. And then things like improved maternity leave and pregnancy leave. But, you know, whenever I say these things, there's always a naysayer who will say, how is this possible? And I say, look at Me Too. Look at gay marriage. Gosh, look at Trump being voted in. For me, this is not a good thing. But and these are all huge shifts in this country that seem to happen almost overnight. But there's been a real uprising around them that leads to them happening. So I feel like, who knows, we could decide in the next few years, we're just going to adopt a different level of maternity leave.
And what about the universal basic income?
Right. So universal basic income is a set amount of money that would be given to each citizen, and it's being piloted in places like Stockton, California, and Ontario. And it's like $12,000 per person or $20,000 per family, roughly. Richard Nixon argued for it in 1969. And in the 1970s, it was referred to as income maintenance, where citizens in certain cities like Gary, Indiana, and Seattle, Washington, were given a certain amount. Alaska has paid residents, given something resembling UBI, $1,000 to $1,500 each. I mean, that seems a little low, but it's not unprecedented. It's not entirely pie in the sky. And I was just thinking what that would have done for someone like some of these adjuncts I had spoken to. So these are some of the solutions in my book. I mean, I have others that are more personal. You know, I hate to tell people to tend their own gardens, but let's say we are thrown back on ourselves. What can we do? Well, we can organize, as people are doing around adjuncts right now, for instance, adjunct professors. There's a group called something like Tenure for the Social Good that's trying to raise awareness and money for adjunct labor? Why are they making $3,000 a class? Why is this the majority of professors in universities? And then there's other kinds of white-collar organizing. I include my own nonprofit economic hardship reporting project. We're giving support to journalists, including low-income journalists. We raise money for newspapers after they're union busting and other kinds of malicious firings. And we created funds for laid-off journalists, and we're planning to create more. So there are things like that that give me hope. And then finally, we can vote for people with family-friendly policies. And locally, it's also extremely important. That's where a lot of these, say, universal pre-K would be local municipal decisions.
The book is called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Author Alyssa Quart is our guest. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Lisa.